The Saffron Robe by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. February 2017, Chapter 14. Oh, oh, wearily I rolled over and lay for a few moments wondering where I was. Reluctantly I came awake. Well, almost. The sky to the east was slightly pink, ice crystals suspended high above in the updraft from the mountain peaks, glittered with prismatic flashes of rainbow hues. Right above me, the heavens were still a deep purple, a purple which lightened even as I watched. My, it was cold. The stone floor was like a block of ice, and I shivered. My one thin blanket was poor protection from my frigid bed. Yawning, I rubbed my knuckles into my eyes, trying to clear away the sleep, trying to put off for a few more minutes the effort of rising on this cold morning. Irritably, still half asleep, I fumbled with my pillow, which by day was my robe. Drugged with the effects of heavy sleep, I fumbled and poked, trying to find which way was up with my robe. In desperation, I could not wake properly. I made a wild guess and pulled the garment around me. With increasing crossness, I discovered that I had it on inside out. Muttering to myself, I tore it off. Literally tore it off, for the rotten old thing split all the way down the back. Gloomily, I surveyed the damage, standing naked in the frosty air. Air so cold that my breath puffed out like a white cloud. Now I was in for it. What would the master of the acolytes say? Damaging lemastic property, wanton carelessness, stupid numbskull of a boy. I knew all that he would say. He'd said it to me so often. We were not issued new robes. As a boy grew out of his robe, he was given another, which some other boy had outgrown. All our robes were old. Some were held together more by faith than by strength. Now my robe was finished, I concluded, as I looked at the sorry remains. Between my finger and thumb, the fabric was thin, empty, and devoid of life. Sadly, I sat down and pulled my blanket around me. What should I do now? Judiciously, I made a few more rents, and then, with my blanket wrapped around me like a robe, I went out in search of the master of the acolytes. When I arrived at his office, he was already saying horrid things to a small boy who wanted a different pair of sandals. Feet were made before sandals, my boy. Feet were made before sandals, he was saying. If I had my way, you'd all go barefoot, but here's another pair. Take care of them. Well, what do you want? He asked as he caught sight of me in my very threadbare blanket. The way in which he looked at me, the way his eyes absolutely glared at the thought of another acolyte wanting something from his precious stores. Honorable Master, I said with considerable trepidation, my robe has split, but it is very, very thin, and was long ago worn out. Worn out, he bawled. I am the one who says, if it's worn out, you miserable boy. Now go about your business, clad in rags, for your audacity. One of the serving monks bent forward and whispered something. The master of the acolyte scowled and bellowed, "What? What? Speak up! Can't you speak up?" The serving monk bawled back, "I said that this boy was recently sent for by the inmost one. He was also sent for by my lord abbot here, and he is the chela of the honorable master Lama Mingyar Danda." Oh, gasped the master of the acolytes. "Why, in the name of Buddha's tooth, didn't you tell me who he was? You're a dolt, an imbecile, worse than any of the acolytes." The master of the acolytes turned to me with a sympathetic smile upon his sharp features. I could see that it was causing him agony to look pleasant. He said, "Let me see the robe, my boy." Silently I passed him my robe with the back portion up so that the tears were the first thing he saw. He took the tattered garment and very gently tugged at it. To my delight, the tear increased, and with a final tug, the garment was in two pieces. The master of the acolytes looked at me with open-mouthed astonishment and said, "Oh, yes, it did tear easily, did it not? Come with me, boy, you shall have a new robe." He put his hand on my elbow, and as he did so, he felt my blanket. Is very threadbare. You must have been as unfortunate with your blanket as with your robe. You shall have a new one." Together we went into a side room. Well, room, it was more like a hall. Robes of all descriptions hung on hooks fixed to the wall. Robes from those of the very high lamas down to the most menial type of garment for lay workers. Keeping my arm in his hand, he led me along with his lips pursed and stopping every so often to feel a garment. It was as if he loved everyone. We came to the part where there were garments for acolytes. We stopped. He fingered his chin and then tugged at the lobes of his ears. "So, you are the boy who was first blown down the mountain and then blown up again to the golden roof. You are the boy who went and saw the inmost one by special command, eh? And you are the boy whom I personally heard talking to the Lord Abbot of this lamasery? And you, well, that's most extraordinary. You have gained the favor of the Lord Abbot himself." He frowned and appeared to be looking into the far distance. My guess was that he was trying to decide if I should have to see the inmost one again, or if I would ever have to see the Lord Abbot again. And who knows, even a small boy can be used to further the aims of an ambitious man. "I'm going to do something very unusual. I'm going to give you a completely new robe, one that was made only last week. If the inmost one has favored you, and the Lord Abbot has favored you, and the great Lama Mingyar Dandap has favored you, then I must see that you are dressed so that you can go to their presence without bringing shame on me." He turned away and led the way to yet another room, an annex off the big store. Here there were new robes which had just been made by monks working under the direction of lamas. He fingered a pile which had not yet been hung up on the racks, and taking out one, he said, "Put it on, let us try it for fit." Quickly I discarded my blanket, being careful to fold it neatly, and then tried on the new robe. as I well knew, if one had a brand new robe, it was a sign to the other acolytes, and to the monks as well, that one had a pull somewhere, and so was a person of some consequence. So I was glad indeed to have a new robe, because while an old robe was sometimes taken as an indication that one had been an acolyte for a long time, a brand new robe was the sign, manual, the one that was important. The new robe fit me well. It was much thicker, and even the few moments it had been upon me had brought a warm glow to my formerly shivering body. "This fits perfectly, master," I said with some pleasure.
"I think we could do a little better than that. Wait a moment."
He dug down into the pile, mumbling and muttering, and every so often fingering his beads. At last he moved aside to another pile and took out a far better quality garment. With a sigh he fairly groaned. "This is one of a special batch. They were made by accident from a superior material, so try this on. I think it will make quite an impression on our seniors." Yes, there was no doubt about it. It was a fine robe. It fitted me well. Rather long, perhaps, coming right down to my feet, but that meant I would have room to grow, and this brand new robe would last me longer. Anyway, a thing that was a bit too big could always be shortened by having a bigger bay in front, and with the bigger pouch in front, I could carry more things around with me. I turned round and round, and the Master of Acolytes looked carefully at me, and then at last he nodded his head, pulled at his lower lip, before remarking with considerable gloom, "Having gone so far, we must surely go a little farther. You shall have that robe, my boy, and I will give you another, because I perceive that you are one who has no spare robe." I found it difficult to follow what he was saying, because he was mumbling away with his back turned to me, digging into the piles of robes. At last he came up with another one, saying, "Now try this one on, see if it fits you also. I know that you are the boy who has been given a special room in the Lama's quarters, so your robe will not be taken from you by a bigger boy." I was delighted. Now I had two robes, one for spare and one for everyday use. The Master of the Acolytes looked with considerable distaste at my blanket and remarked, "Oh, yes, we were going to give you a new blanket. Come with me and bring that one with you." He hastened along ahead of me out into the main storage hall and called for a monk, who came bringing a ladder with him. Quickly, the monk went up the ladder and took from the shelves a blanket. It contrasted rather too much with my robe, so with a groan of sheer anguish, the Master of the Acolytes took the steps himself and went back into the side room, returning after a few moments with his eyes half closed and with a superior quality blanket. "Take it, my boy, take it," he quavered. "This is one of our better blankets, made by accident from superior stock. Take it, and remember, when you see the Lord Abbot, or the Inmost One, that I have treated you well and outfitted you grandly. In all seriousness, I tell you that the Master of the Acolytes cupped his hands over his eyes while he groaned at the thought of parting with his better quality materials.
"I am much indebted to you, honorable master," was my reply. "I am sure that my master, the Lama Mingyar Dandap, will very speedily perceive your goodness in giving me these garments. Thank you." With that off my chest, I turned and made my way out of the storeroom. As I did so, one of the serving monks outside solemnly winked at me, and I had much difficulty in not laughing out loud. Back I went up the corridor and into the enclosure of the Lama's quarters. As I was hastening along with a robe and a blanket in my arms, I almost bumped into my guide. "Oh, honorable master," I exclaimed, "I am so sorry, but I could not see you." My guide laughed at me, saying, "You look like a traveling salesman, Lobsang. You look as if you've just come back over the mountains from India. Have you set up as a trader by any chance?" I told him about my misfortunes, told him about how my robe had split all the way down. I told him, too, that the master of acolytes had been telling a boy that he would have all boys go barefooted. My guide led the way into his room, and we sat down. Immediately, my interior gave notice that I had had no food, and fortunately for me, my guide heard that too, and he smiled as he said, "So, you too have not yet broken your fast. Then let us break our fast together." And with that, reached out his hand and rang his little silver bell. With Sampa before us, we made no remarks until we had finished our meal. After, when the monk had cleared away the dishes, my guide said, "So, you have made an impression on the master of the acolytes. You must have made a sound impression to get two good robes and a new blanket. I shall have to see if I can emulate you." "Master, I am very curious about clothing, for if the master of the acolyte says we should all go without sandals, then why should we not go about without clothes?" My guide laughed at me and remarked, "Many years ago, of course, people did not wear clothes, and because they did not wear clothes, they did not feel the lack of such garments, because in those days, people were able to have their bodies compensate for a much wider range of temperatures. But now, through using clothes, we have become effete, and we have ruined our heat-regulating mechanisms by abusing them." He fell silent, musing the problem, and then he laughed as he continued, "But can you imagine some of the old fat monks around here going about with nothing on? It would be quite a sight." But the story of clothes is a very interesting one, because in the first case, people wore no clothing at all, and thus there was no treachery, because each person could see the aura of others. But at last the leaders of the tribes of those days decided that they needed something to distinguish themselves as leaders. So they would use a bunch of feathers strategically placed, or a few coats of paint made from various berries. But then the ladies came into the picture. They wanted to be decorated also, and they used bunches of leaves, even more strategically placed. My guide laughed at the thought of all these people, and I could conjure up quite a good picture myself. He continued, When the head man and the head woman of each tribe had got themselves all decorated, then the next in line of succession had to have some decoration also, and thus they became indistinguishable from the head man and the head woman. So the head man, the head woman had to add even more decorations, and so the matter went on for quite a time, each leading man adding more clothing. Eventually, the leading women wore clothing which was definitely suggestive, clothing intended to half reveal that which should not be concealed. For, do not misunderstand me, when people could see the aura, then there would be no treachery, no wars, no double dealings. It was only since people started wearing clothing that they ceased to be able to see the aura, and they ceased to be clairvoyant and telepathic. He looked hard at me and said, "Now you pay attention to me, because this has much bearing on the task which you will have to do later." I nodded to show that I really was paying attention. My guide continued, "A clairvoyant who can see the astral of another has to be able to see the unclad body if he is to be able to give a quite accurate reading of any illness. And when people wear clothing, their aura becomes contaminated." I sat up in some astonishment at that, because I did not see how clothing could contaminate an aura, and I said so. My guide soon answered me, "A person is naked, so the aura from that person is the aura of that person, and not of anything else. Now if you put a yak wool garment on the person, you take in the auric influence of the yak, the person who sheared the yak, the person who combed and carded the wool, and the person who actually wove the material. So if you're going to bother about the aura as seen through clothing, you may be able to tell of the intimate history of the yak and its family, which is not at all what you want." "But master," was my anxious question, "how does clothing contaminate an aura?" "Well, I've just told you. Everything that exists has its own field of influence, its own magnetic field, and if you take a view through the window, you can see the bright daylight. But if you pull our oiled silk screens across, you see the bright daylight, which is now modified by the influence of the oiled silk screens. In other words, what you actually see is a bluish tinge to that light, and that would not at all help you in describing what sunlight was like." He smiled rather wryly at me as he continued, "It is rather remarkable, really, that people are so unwilling to part with their clothing. I always have had the theory that people have a racial memory, that, without clothing, their aura could be seen and read by others. And so many people nowadays have such guilty thoughts that they dare not let anyone else know what is on their mind, and so they keep clothing on their body, which is a sign of guilt masquerading under the misnomer of purity and innocence." He reflected for a few moments and then remarked, "Many religions say that man is made in the image of God, but then man is ashamed of his body, which seems to imply that man is ashamed of the image of God. It is all very puzzling how people go on. You will find in the West that people show surprising amounts of flesh in certain areas, but they cover other areas so that attention is automatically drawn to it. In other words, Lobsang, many women wear clothing which is completely suggestive. They wear padded portions, which were also known as gay deceivers when I was in the West. All these pads are designed to make a man think a woman has that which she has not. In the same way as just a few years ago, men of the West wore things inside their trousers, which they called cod pieces. That is, there were certain pads of material which were meant to convey the impression that a man was generously endowed and thus would be a very virile partner. Unfortunately, the ones with the most padding were the least virile. But another great difficulty with clothing is that it keeps out fresh air. If people would wear less clothing and would have air baths, their health would greatly improve. There would be less cancer and very much less TB, because when a person is all swaddled up with clothing, air cannot circulate and germs multiply. I thought about that, and I just did not see for one moment how germs would multiply if a person wore clothes, and I expressed that view. My guide responded, "Lobsang, if you look about you on the ground, you see many insects. But if you lift a rotten log or move a big stone, you'll find all sorts of things beneath. Insects, worms, and various types of creatures which breed and live only in the dark and secluded places are there. In the same way, the body is covered with bacteria, covered with germs. The action of light prevents the germs and the bacteria from multiplying. It has an effect of keeping the body healthy. But as soon as one allows pockets of stagnant air to rest in the darkness of thick clothing, one gets all sorts of bacteria multiplying." He looked at me quite seriously as he said, "Later, when you are a doctor treating patients, you will find that if a dressing is left too long untended, maggots will form beneath in just the same way as when a stone is left on the ground, insects will collect beneath it. But that is a thing you will deal with in the future." He rose to his feet and stretched and said, "But now we have to go out. I think I'll give you 5 minutes to get ready and then go down to the stables, because we're going on a journey together." With that, he motioned for me to pick up my spare robe and blanket and take them to my own room. I bowed to him and gathered my bundle and turned through the communicating door. For a few moments, I was busy getting myself ready, and then I made my way down to the stables as directed. As I went out into the open of the courtyard, I stopped in amazement. There was quite a cavalcade being assembled. For some moments, I hung about against one of the walls, moving from foot to foot, as I wondered whoever all this was for. For a moment I thought one of the abbots was getting ready to move, but then my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, appeared and looked rapidly around. Seeing me, he beckoned. My heart sank as I realized that all this commotion was for us. There was a horse for my guide and a smaller horse for me. In addition, there were 4 monk attendants, each mounted on a horse, and as well as that, there were 4 more horses, laden with bundles and packages, but laden in such a way that they were not carrying too much weight, so that 2 of them could, at any time, be used as spares in order that the heavier men would not overtire their own horses. There was much heavy breathing through nostrils, the stamping of feet and the swishing of tails, and I walked forward, exerting the greatest care not to get behind any of those horses, for once before a playful horse had lured me behind him, and then he had planted a hoof with considerable force in the middle of my chest, knocking me over, and actually cartwheeling me onto the ground. Since then, I had exercised great care. "Well, we're going up into the mountains," Lob Sang, "for 2 or 3 days, and you're going to be my assistant." His eyes twinkled as he said that. Actually, it was another stage in my training. Together, we walked to our horses, and the one allotted to me turned his head and really shuddered as he recognized me. His eyes rolled, and he neighed his bitter protest. My sympathy was entirely with him, because I did not like him any more than he liked me. But a monk groom quickly extended his cupped hands and helped me onto my horse. My guide was already mounted on his and was waiting. The monk groom whispered, "This is a quiet horse. You shouldn't have any trouble with this one, not even you." My guide looked about him, checking that I was just behind him, and that the 4 monk attendants were also in position, and the 4 pack horses were attached by long tethers. Then he raised his hand, and we rode off down the mountain. Horses allotted to me seemed to have one thing in common. Whenever there was a particularly steep part, the wretched beast would put his head down, and I had to cling on to prevent myself from sliding over his neck. This time I braced my feet behind his ears. He liked that no more than I liked his head being down. The terraced road was jerky, and there was much traffic, and I had all my abilities concentrated on staying on my horse. But I did manage, as we rounded a bend, once to glance up and out across the parkland to that which had once been my home and was now my home no longer. Down we went, down the mountain, and turned left into the Linkore Road. We plodded on over the river bridge, and as we came in sight of the Chinese mission, we suddenly turned right on the road which led to the Kashia Linga, and I wondered why such an entourage would be going just to that little park. My guide had given me no indication of where we were going except to the mountains. And as there were mountains all around Lhasa, enclosing us in a sort of a bowl, that was no guide at all to our destination. Suddenly I jumped for joy, so suddenly that my wretched horse started to buck, thinking that I was attacking him or something. However, I managed to hang on and pulled the reins so tight that his head came right back, and that soon made him quiet. And so I had learned a lesson. Keep a tight rein, and your seat is safe, I hoped. We went on at a steady walk, and soon reached a widening of the road where there were a number of traders just disembarking from the ferries. My guide dismounted, and his senior monk attendant dismounted also, and strode over to the ferryman. For a few moments there was conversation, and then the monk came back, saying, "It is all right, Honorable Lama. We go now." Immediately there was bustle and confusion. The monk attendants got off their horses and all converged on the pack horses. The loads were removed and carried into the boat of the ferryman. Then all the horses were tied together with long leads, and two attendant monks each mounted a horse and walked them into the river. I watched as they started out, the monks pulling their robes right up around them, right up beyond their waists, and the horses all bravely plunged into the water and swimming away across to the other side. My guide, I saw with some astonishment, was already in the boat and motioning me to enter also. So for the first time in my life, I clambered aboard a boat to be followed by the other two attendants. With a muttered word to his assistant, the ferryman pushed off. For a moment there was a sensation of giddiness because the boat spun around in a circle. This boat was made of the skins of yaks, carefully stitched together and made waterproof. Then the thing was inflated with air. People and their goods got in, and the boatman just took long sweeps or oars and paddled slowly across the river. Whenever there was a wind against him, he took a long, long time, but he always made up for it on the return journey, because then it was the question of guiding and the wind blowing. I was too excited to know much about that first trip across the water. I know that I clutched the sides of the skin boat, so there was some danger of my fingers, with sharp nails, penetrating. I was, in any case, afraid to move, because every time I tried to move, something sagged beneath me. It was almost as if we were resting on nothingness, and it was not at all like resting upon a good solid stone floor which did not rock. In addition, the water was rather choppy, and I came to the conclusion that I had eaten too much, for curious qualms assailed me in the stomach, and I was very frightened that I would be heartily sick in front of all those men. However, by holding my breath at judicious intervals, I managed to preserve my honor, and soon the boat grated on a shallow, pebbly beach, and we alighted. Our cavalcade reassembled, my guide in the lead, and I at a half-horse length behind him. Then the four monk attendants riding two and two, and after that the four pack horses. My guide looked about to make sure that everyone was ready, and then his horse stepped forward towards the morning. We sat and sat while our horses jogged on and on. All the time we were facing the west, the direction in which this morning had gone, for we say that the sun rises in the east and travels west, taking the morning with it. Soon the sun overtook us and was dead overhead. There was no cloud, and the rays of the sun were scorching indeed, but when we came into the shadow of great rocks, the cold was bitter, because at our altitude there was insufficient air to balance out the hot rays of the sun, and the coldness of the shadows. We rode on for perhaps another hour, and then my guide came to a part in the trail which apparently he used as a stopping place. Without any signals that I could perceive, the monks got off their horses and immediately started to boil water, taking dried yak dung, which we used as fuel, and going to a nearby mountain stream for water. In about half an hour, we were sitting down having our sampa, and I, for one, certainly felt the need of it. The horses were also fed, and then they were all taken off to the mountain stream so they could be watered. I sat with my back against a boulder which looked to be about as big as the buildings of Shakpuri Temple. I looked out from our high position across the valley of Lhasa. The air was absolutely clear, no haze, no dust, and we could see everything with utter clarity. We could see pilgrims going by the western gate. We could see the traders, and we could look far back down the trail and see the boatman bringing yet another load of passengers across the Happy River. Soon it was time to move on. So the horses were again loaded, and we all mounted, and then rode along up the mountain path, going deeper and deeper into the foothills of the Himalayas. Soon we abandoned the established road, which eventually led into India, and we turned left where the road, or rather a track at this time, became steeper and steeper, and where our progress became much slower. Above us, perched on a ledge, we could see a small lamassery. I looked at it with great interest because it was a source of some fascination for me. It was a lamassery of a slightly different order, an order in which the monks and lamas were all married, and they lived in the building with their families. We went on and on, hour after hour, and soon drew level with this lamassery of a different order. We could see monks and nuns walking about together, and I was quite surprised to see that the nuns also had shaven heads. Here they had dark faces, faces which glistened, and then my guide whispered to me, "Here there are many sandstorms, so they all wear a thick mask of grease which preserves the skin. Later, too, we shall have to put on leather face masks." It was a fortunate thing that my horse was sure-footed and knew more about the mountain trails than I did, because my attention was completely upon this small lamassery. I could see small children playing about, and it really puzzled me why there should be some monks who lived a celibate life and others who got married, and I wondered why it should make such a break between two branches of the same religion. The monks and nuns just looked up at our passing and took no more notice of us, took less notice of us than if we had been traders. We climbed on, and above us we saw a white and ochre building perched upon what I should have called a holy, inaccessible ledge of rock. My guide pointed it out. That is where we're going, Lobsang, up to that hermitage. We have to get up there tomorrow morning, because the way is dangerous indeed. Tonight we shall sleep here among the rocks. We rode on for perhaps another mile, and then we stopped amid a cluster of rocks, great rocks, which formed almost a saucer. We rode the horses in among the rocks, and then we all dismounted. The horses were tethered and fed. We had our sampa, and then night was upon us, like the drawing of a curtain. I rolled myself in my blanket and peered out between two rocks. I could see various glimmers of light from Shakpori and from the Patala. The moon was shining very brightly, and the Happy River might well have been named the Silver River, for it was shining as a streak of purest bright silver. The night was still, no breath of wind, no movement, not even a night bird called. The stars were gleaming bright in their myriad hues above. On the instant, I fell asleep. I had a good night's rest with no interruptions for temple services, no interruptions for anything. But in the morning, when I awakened, I felt I had been trampled by a herd of yaks. Every bone ached, and I felt I would not be able to sit down with any degree of comfort. Then I remembered that wretched horse, and I hoped he ached as well, although I had grave doubts about that. Soon our little camp was abustle with serving monks who were preparing sampa. I wandered away while they were doing so, and stood gazing out across the valley of Lhasa. Then I turned and looked up at the hermitage some quarter of a mile above. It looked a strange place. It reminded me of one of those birds' nests that are stuck tight against the wall of a house, and which one always expected to fall and shatter at any moment. I could not see any path, or any way at all, of reaching the hermitage. I wandered back and had my sampa and listened to the men talk. As soon as we had finished our breakfast, my guide said, "Well, we shall have to be moving, Lobsang. The horses and three of the monk attendants remain here, and we and one of the attendants move up." My heart sank at the thought of that. How was I going to walk all the way up the mountainside? I was sure that if the horses couldn't travel that way, neither could I. However, ropes were obtained from one of the horses and draped about the monk attendant. Then I carried one bag of I know not what, and my guide took another, while the rather bulky monk attendant took the third. The three monks left behind looked very happy that they were going to have some time alone without any supervision, without anything to do except look after the horses. We set out and plodded up between the rocks, finding a precarious foothold when we could. Soon the way became worse and worse, and the monk attendant took the lead, throwing a rope with two stones attached to the end. He would throw, make a quick jerk, and the stones would swing around and trap the rope, and then he would pull to see if it was straight, after which he would pull himself up with the rope. Then, reaching the end, he would steady it so that my guide and I could make our slow, dangerous way. The process was repeated time after time. Eventually, after one particularly arduous effort, we reached a platform of rock, a platform that was perhaps 30 feet wide and had obviously been carved out by some age-old avalanche. As I thankfully reached it and pulled myself over the edge, climbing first to my knees, then to my feet, I turned my gaze to the right, and there, several feet away from me, was the Hermitage. For some moments we stood there, all of us panting, while we got our breath back. I was enthralled with the view. I could look down upon the golden roof of the Patala. I could look also into the courtyards of the Shakpori. I could see that obviously a fresh load of herbs had just arrived, for the place was like a disturbed beehive. Monks were scurrying in all directions. There was much traffic, too, through the western gate. But then, I sighed, this was not for me. I had, instead, to go climbing silly mountains and to go to meet people in hermitages, when who but an idiot would live walled up in an hermitage? Now, there were signs of activity, because from the hermitage, three men approached. One was very, very old, and was being supported by two younger men. As they came towards us, we picked up our baggage and advanced to the Hermitage. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15. The old man was blind. Totally blind. I looked at his eyes with wonder. They were peculiar. For some time I could not place what it was that made me think they were so strange, and then I heard how he had been made blind. In Tibet, hermits are immured in deep cells within an hermitage. The cells are completely and utterly without light, and after 3 years or 7 years, if a man wants to be let out, if he feels that his self-imposed withdrawal should end, then it takes a considerable time. First, a very small hole is made in the roof so that a minute trace of light can then enter. After several days, the hole is made larger, so that after perhaps a month, the man inside is able to see again, because during his incarceration, the pupils of the eye open fully, and if light should suddenly enter, the man would instantly be struck blind. This old man had been in a cell, one side of which had been hit by a falling rock, tearing it off. At one moment, the hermit had been sitting in the cell where he had sat for some 20 years. The next thing was a terrific crash and a rumble, and the side of his hermitage had been torn away, and the old man was looking directly into the face of the burning sun. Instantly, he had been struck blind. I listened to what the old man was telling my guide. So, in accordance with custom, we provided the food on the first day, and on the second day, and on the third day, but the food was untouched, and thus, as our brother does not answer, we believe that his soul has taken wing away from the empty shell of the body. My guide took the old man by the arm and said, "Do not be disturbed, my brother, for we will look into the matter. Perhaps you will lead us to the cell?" The others turned and led the way in, and across their small courtyard. To the left, there was a series of small cells, five cells I observed, very bare, very barren of comforts, for they were just cells, just stone caves in the rocky side of the mountain. No tables, no tankas, nothing. Just a stone floor upon which a monk could sit or lie in sleep. We passed those and we entered a large dark room, a room which was perched precariously on a rocky spur jutting out from the side of the mountain. It looked like a shaky contraption to me, but apparently it had survived there for a couple of hundred years. In the center of this large, gloomy room was another room. As we went to it, the darkness increased. Butter lamps were brought, and we entered a small corridor, which was pitch dark, about 10 paces, and we came up against a blank wall. The butter lamps shed a feeble glow, which seemed to accentuate the darkness. My guide took one of the lamps and held it just about chest level, and then I saw there was a very closely fitting trap door. My guide opened it and felt about in what appeared to be a cupboard. Loudly he rapped on the inner side of the cupboard and listened carefully. Then he put his lamp inside, and I saw that it was apparently a box let into the wall. My guide said, "This is a box, Lobsang, with two doors, this door and a door inside. The occupant of the cell waits until a certain time, then he opens his door, feels about and removes food and water placed for him. He never sees light. He never speaks to anyone. He is, in fact, under a vow of silence. Now we have the problem that he's been here without food for several days, and we don't know if he's alive or dead." He looked at the opening, and then he looked at me. Looking back to the opening, he measured it with his hand and arm, and then he measured me, after which he said, "It seems to me that if you took off your robe, you could just possibly scrape through this opening and force open the door on the other side. Then you could see if the monk was indeed in need of attention." "Oh, master," I exclaimed in complete fright, "what happens if I go through and can't get out?" My guide thought for a moment, and then he answered, "First, you shall be lifted up so that you're supported. Then you can, with a stone, batter in the inner door. When you have battered it in, we shall slide you in, and you can hold a lamp in your outstretched hands. It should be bright enough to permit you to see if the man is in need of help." My guide went into the other room and took 3 butter lamps, prying the wicks out of 2 of them, and putting the 3 together, twisted into 1 lamp, which he very carefully packed with butter. In the meantime, one of the monks had gone out into the open, and he now returned, carrying quite a substantial rock. He handed it to me, and I hefted it for weight and balance. "Master, why can't the monk answer a question?" I asked. "Because he's under oath. He's under a vow not to speak for a certain time," was the response. I reluctantly shed my robe, shivering in the cold mountain air. Shakpuri was cold enough, but here it was colder still. The chill was biting. I kept on my sandals because the floor was like a block of ice. In the meantime, a monk had taken the stone and had given a good bonk against the inner door, which sprang out of its frame with a loud crash. But the others, although they tried hard, were not able to see into the inner cell. Their heads were too big, their shoulders were too wide. So my guide held me horizontally, and I extended my hands as if I was going to dive, and one of the monks lit the three wicks, now fixed in the butter lamp, putting it carefully between my hands. Then I slid forward. I found the frame of the wretched cupboard or passage very rough, but with many a grunt and exclamation, I eased into the box-like entrance, being twisted sideways and joggled to and fro, so that at last my arms and head protruded. Immediately, I was overcome by a sickening stench. It was absolutely foul. It was the smell of rotting meat, the smell of things gone bad. One smelt something the same when one chanced upon a dead yak or a dead horse, which had been kept too long. It was a smell which reminded me of all the sanitary appliances in the world which had gone wrong at the same time. I was absolutely gagging with the stench, but I managed to control myself enough to hold the light aloft, and in its flickering gleams reflected from the stone walls, I could see the old monk. His eyes were shining at me. He was staring at me. And I jumped so much with fright that I scraped a whole lot of skin from my shoulders. I gazed back at him, and then I saw that his eyes were shining in the reflected light, but they did not blink. They did not waver. I waggled my feet as a signal that I wanted to be out in a hurry. Gently, I was pulled back, and then I was sick, sick, sick. "We cannot leave him here," said my guide. "We shall have to knock the wall down and get him out." I recovered from my nausea and put on my robes. The others got tools consisting of a heavy hammer and two iron bars with flattened ends. Then they applied the iron bars to niches in a far part of the wall and hammered. Gradually a block was removed, and then another and another. The stench was terrible. At last the opening was big enough for a man to enter, and one of the monks entered, bearing two butter lamps. Soon he returned, looking gray-faced, and he repeated my performance, which I was glad to note. "We shall have to put a rope around him and drag him out," said that monk. "He is falling to pieces. He is very much in a state of decay." Silently, a monk left the room and shortly returned with a long length of rope. Entering the hole in the wall, where the door had originally been walled up, we heard him moving about, and then he returned. "It's all right, you can pull," he said. Two monks gently took the rope and pulled. Soon the old man's head appeared and his arms. He was in a terrible state. The monks carefully pulled him out, and then he was lifted up by tender hands and borne outside. At the far side of the room there was a small trail leading farther up the mountain. The two monks, with their burden, ascended the path and disappeared out of our sight. I knew that they were going to take the body to a flat surface where the vultures would soon devour it, because there was no chance of burying bodies here in the hard mountain rocks. We depended upon air burial. While this was being done, the monk attendant who was with us had made a small hole in the far side of the wall that let in a dull gleam of light. Then he took pails of water and swilled down the inner cell, cleaning it from its last occupant. Soon, how soon, there would be someone else taking over that cell, who would live there for 10, 20, how many years? Later that day we were all sitting down, and the old blind man said, "I can feel that here we have one who is destined to travel far and to see much. I have received information about him from when my hands touched his head. Boy, sit before me." Reluctantly, I moved forward and sat right in front of the old blind man. He lifted his hands, they were as cold as ice, and placed them upon my shaven skull. His fingers lightly traced the outline of my head and probed various bumps I had. Then he spoke, "You are going to have a very hard life." I groaned to myself. Everyone was telling me I was going to have a hard life, and I was getting heartily sick of the whole affair. "After you have had hardships, trials, and tribulations that fall to few, you will, just before the end, have success. You will do that for which you came to this world." I had heard it all before. I had been to soothsayers, seers, astrologers, clairvoyants. Every one of them had told me the same type of thing. After having told me that, he just waved his hands, so I got up and moved as far away as I could, an act which caused him to cackle with some amusement. My guide and the others were in long discussion on very serious matters. It did not make much sense to me. They were talking about prophecies and things that were going to happen in Tibet. They were telling about the best methods of preserving the sacred knowledge, and how already steps were being made to take various books and articles high up into the mountains, where they'd be hidden in caves. They were saying, too, how counterfeit things were going to be left in the temples, so that the old, old genuine articles would not fall into the hands of the invader of later years. I moved out of the enclosure and sat on a rock, gazing out where, far below, the city of Lhasa was now hidden by the gloom of the fast approaching night. Only the higher peaks of Shakpori and the Patala were still in the faint dusk light. They appeared to be like two islands floating upon a sea of the deepest purple. As I sat there, gradually the islands appeared to submerge in the all-pervading darkness. Then, as I sat, a bright shaft of moonlight, striking down over the mountain edge, touched the roof of the Patala, which lit up with golden gleams. I turned and walked inside the enclosure, where I took off my robe, rolled myself in a blanket, and fell asleep. End of chapter 15, and end of the saffron robe.